to jump in, you know, we really bring different sets of experiences to this. Yours much newer, but for that very reason, unique. And you probably have perspective that I don't. So why don't we begin with you saying a word about how did you even discover the process movement? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a number of years ago now, and it was through Whitehead in particular initially. I'd heard the name Charles Hartshorne previously as well, but Whitehead had popped up in a number of different contexts for me, reading different religious studies, scholars, different philosophers. And I was really in a period of trying to explore some of the most unique and kind of vibrant developments in 20th century philosophy broadly, mm-hmm. but specifically stuff that related to religion, theology, metaphysics in particular. And so, yeah, Whitehead definitely plugs right in there. I know that the first time I ever encountered John Cobb and his work was on the Psychedelics Today podcast in 2019, where really? he was a guest, I think in conjunction with a conference that the center put on back then. It might have been the kind of Extraordinary Experiences conference. So yeah, Joe Moore and Kyle Buller, I believe, were interviewing John Cobb, and he was giving kind of a Whiteheadian account of how kind of psychedelic experiences and transformative and kind of altered states in general can be kind of understood through this this experiential metaphysics of Whitehead. So that was part of it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, that may be a jumping off point for me. I took a course in Process and Reality under John Cobb. And at the very same time, I was the English teacher for a Zen Buddhist priest from Japan. And so literally, in the mornings, I would go have a course with John Cobb talking about process and reality. And in the afternoons, teach my friend English, but talk about Zen the whole time. And that led me to see Whitehead's analysis of experience as uniquely Zen in spirit, because there was the active experiencing in the moment of concrescence, but there was no separate experiencer. The experiencer was the experiencing. And that resonated really with what I was learning from my Zen teacher, Kato Fukushima from Kyoto, Japan, as the wisdom of no self. So sometimes no self or anatman is described as no underlying substance undergoing change through time. True. But it's also understood as no separate experiencer apart from the act of experiencing. So that led me to read Process and Reality with a somewhat unique set of eyes. I don't know if many other people have read Process and Reality as immediately shaped by Zen Buddhism, as was I. But I was and still am a Christian. And so when it got to the part about God and Process and Reality, I liked it a lot. But what was I going to do with that and my ongoing dialogue with Zen? And that was a rather deep, intense period for me. The question was God or emptiness? God or emptiness? Emptiness or God? That was the way it was framed in my mind. And I found that Whitehead offered a unique way to say both, but without conflating the two. Because in Whitehead, God had that personal side, fellow sufferer who understands. And I think Whitehead felt some of that personal side of God. And you sure couldn't find that in Zen. That was just foreign to Zen. It's not foreign to Pure Land Buddhism, but it's foreign to Zen. So that was my big dilemma. One more thing about that, though, a little known fact about John, or you don't much hear it mentioned anymore, is he had about a 5, 6, 10 year rather intensive dialogue with Buddhism going on in his life. And that was through Masao Abe, who was Shinichi Hisamatsu's, a student of Shinichi Hisamatsu, who was in the Kyoto world. And Abe visited Claremont, and I was Abe's student assistant. So I got to know Abe pretty well, too. And I got to know John's work on Buddhism very well. And I do hope that that's part of John's legacy. Sometimes that's neglected. So there's enough of Whitehead Zen and John Cobb for me. Back to you. So tell me what happened after that. So you led a reading study on Whitehead's religion in the making, as I recall. Is that correct?
Yeah.
How'd that go?
Yeah, that was great. That was kind of my first formal introduction to any of Whitehead's thought and kind of a more formal kind of process, metaphysic for sure. It went well. I will say, so I'd been reading a number of different texts in a reading group I was organizing, all kind of in this philosophy, religion, 20th century vein. So the Kyoto school that you just mentioned, we also read Keiji Nishitani's Religion and Nothingness, and that was really well received. We read Alone with the Alone, Creative Imagination in the Sufism of Ibn Arabi by Henri Corbin, this 20th century phenomenologist, philosopher, Islamic thinker, very interesting guy. We read Knowledge in the Sacred by Sayyid Hussein Nasser, a living Iranian philosopher, theologian in this perennialist, traditionalist school. I think there was maybe one or two others, but yeah, that was kind of our reading list there. I think a lot of the folks in our group had the most quibbles with Whitehead of those authors in some ways. Part of that was that this was simply an older text than the rest of what we were reading. The rest of these texts were more later 20th century. I think Knowledge in the Sacred might have even been early 21st century. And so you got some stuff from the times in terms of considering primitive civilizations, language like that.
That's right.
So that was part of it. But then, yeah, I mean, the process metaphysic is also just very different than either the somewhat more traditional Zen perspective we were getting in Nishitani. I mean, big asterisk there. He's a lot more than just a traditional Zen thinker. Or the more classic Sufi perspective in Henri Corbin. And both him and Sayyid Hussein Nasser certainly drawing from a broadly Abrahamic, Neoplatonic lineage as well. And in so many ways, that's a tradition that Whitehead and many of his followers invert in certain respects. And so that was a lot to grapple with for sure. But I mean, definitely rewarding. And I think as I've gotten more and more into Whitehead's thought and the process perspective more generally, I've found it more and more useful, kind of broadly applicable, just a really excellent intellectual tool in the toolbox for doing all kinds of different analyses and investigations of different things, whether in the sciences, in something in human experience, something in like something social. I think Whitehead did really succeed in making a metaphysical framework that's very general and applicable as he intended to. But I mean, it's certainly something with an incredibly high barrier to entry. So,
well, it's hard to enter. As you know, I've had struggle is not the right word, but I'm drawn to Neoplatonic ways of thinking. And I've read Nasser, and I've read, is it Corbin?
Yeah, I mean, people will say Corbin, but yeah, if we're doing it the French way, Corbin.
Mm-hmm. And I read your essay on Corbin, and I was surprised when I read your essay of a critique of Corbin. It wasn't all sympathy. There was a critique. But in any case, that whole world has always made sense to me, and also forms of Christian mysticism drawing upon that world. So the whole idea of an emanationist perspective, that the universe is an emanation of the divine, that the universe in a way is made of God, not creation out of nothing, not creation out of pre-existing matter, but the creation out of God's self, such that everything is akin to sparks coming from a single source. I get that. But I mean, it rings intuitively true in some ways and in some moments. I also get the reasons why people resist that for a couple of reasons. One is the reality of evil. Is rape and murder and hatred and greed and injustice and violence, is that all God-godding? And also the question of freedom. Do the sparks have some creativity of their own? use Whitehead's word, self-creativity. That's the word he uses. If they do, then they're not exactly just God-godding. They're themselves theming, you might say. And so I think those issues took Whitehead in a kind of inverted direction, as you will say, made him more of a pluralist, actually. And I don't find much in him that wants to say the whole universe is a manifestation of the divine. I find a lot of Whiteheadians want to say that, but I don't find it in Whitehead. So anyway, but I've appreciated that dimension of your thought, that you too seem to kind of move between those perspectives. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but how about for you?
Yeah, I mean, definitely so. I think these are perspectives that can really productively be put in dialogue and in relation. In such a way that, I mean, it's kind of a, I hold it as kind of a almost irresolvable tension a bit. Mm-hmm. It's not like the process perspective is ever going to overcome and mm-hmm. subsume the more traditional Neoplatonic thought, and likewise for the inverse. So, I mean, if you're looking for a kind of neat, finalized metaphysical system, I don't know that is going to be a satisfying option, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for things that are existentially viable and productive, of kind of increasing degrees of insight and kind of contact with different dimensions of life and experience. So for that, a great combo for the job, I think. So
so you're not looking for a final answer?
I think not. Yeah, I think maybe let's leave our metaphysical systems open and in constant dialogue with new frontiers of all sorts of different things. So
another influence on me that I don't much hear in you or in some others is Martin Heidegger. And he, particularly in his analysis of existence and in Being in Time, not just his analysis of human existence, but his description of his taking ordinary lived human experience as a point of departure for ontology. You know, the question for Heidegger in Being in Time was not what are human beings as such. It is what is the being of beings, the primary instance of which we have is our own being. But he says in the first paragraph of Being in Time, my question is ontological. And he thought, it's been forgotten in the history of Western philosophy. It's what is the being of beings? What is that? What is being? And for me, that question is somewhat different from metaphysics. I take metaphysics as kind of seeking some kind of conceptual framework in terms of which to understand the cosmos and human life and this, that, and the other, with categories. But Heidegger's question was different. It was not that kind of metaphysics. And for that reason, he was critical of metaphysics. And he thought metaphysics is an expression of the will to power, the desire to enframe things within a conceptual box at the expense of awakening the being of beings. Is there anything in you that's any analogy in your own thought to that critique of metaphysics?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important dialogue partner here as well. I think it'd be great to get the Heideggerian strand of existentialism and phenomenology more in conversation with the process thought. It's been, unfortunately somewhat minimal from my exposure anyways. I mean, certainly in conferences here and there and these kind of papers and stuff, but beyond the more kind of ivory tower stuff, these are discourses that have not kind of reached more of a public audience yet. So I mean, that'd be a great topic for kind of further exploration on our series here, for sure. I'd be excited to dive deeper in there. Is there anything analogous in what's going on for me conceptually, metaphysically, ontologically to the Heideggerian stuff? I mean, that's in me a little bit. I've mostly absorbed Heidegger through kind of secondary sources. I mean, definitely Nishitani has a lot of Heidegger in him, and he's very in conversation with the kind of Heideggerian system, if it can be called as such. And and I mean, it's been interesting kind of tracking some of these broader trends in both 20th century and now 21st century philosophy. And I mean, yeah, you had a really strong kind of anti-metaphysical bent to 20th century philosophy coming out of Heidegger. But I mean, there's certainly arguments for this stance in kind of the analytic world as well. And the process people were always kind of doing something different in that we very much were trying to do speculative metaphysics. And I think nowadays the tides have turned a bit we see more of a kind of general interest in, let's maybe try doing some of this metaphysical stuff again. And I think a big part of that is people have realized it's a pretty foundational, aspect of thinking that you kind of can't get around. I mean, you can bracket metaphysical questions and do kind of all kinds of work outside of those things. And I mean, that's kind of how I understand a lot of the phenomenological tradition. Certainly worthwhile. There's plenty of really rich and fruitful stuff that's come out of there. But especially once we're entering into dialogues about science and religion, it seems like bracketing can kind of only get you so far when you're dealing with domains that kind of in their essential self-understanding are trying to say something about quote-unquote reality. So if you bracket the metaphysics, a lot of what happens is you're just kind of operating with an unconscious metaphysics, which may or may not be kind of valid or substantiated in various ways. So allowing ourselves some space to do kind of intentional speculative metaphysics seems to be very valuable in those domains of science and religion in particular. I think the more we can be doing that again nowadays, especially on the other side of this critique of of metaphysics that we really saw in the past couple of centuries of Western philosophy. But I mean, certainly you can find critiques of metaphysics in non-Western thought too, and bringing those into the conversation as well would be helpful. But yeah, having a little more of a humility, and I think Whitehead's kind of goal is really, really laudable in kind of keeping the metaphysics open, making sure it's in deep conversation with experience and other kind of evolving sources of information, data that we should be basing our metaphysics upon. I think that's probably the right way to be going about things, rather than trying to just come up with this kind of elegant abstract system, which is a little more what the classical metaphysics was about. And again, I find a lot of that stuff valuable, but it can be harder to keep that an open system to where it can accommodate new frontiers of experience as our collective experience as humans seems to be developing, and yeah, having novelty enter in. So be great to be able to include that in these metaphysical speculations.
I think it's sometimes forgotten that in the process tradition, there really kind of were three traditions. And this is from a thinker named Delwyn Brown and Sheila Greve Devaney. They wrote an article on the three methodological traditions in the process tradition movement. And they were the speculative tradition, which they traced to Whitehead and John Cobb's appropriation thereof. There was also a rational, what they called a rationalist tradition, and that was Charles Hartshorne, and then a student of Charles Hartshorne's, a man named Schubert Ogden. I don't know if you've heard know the name. And then a third was what they called the empirical tradition, and that was Bernard Luhmer and Bernard Maland. And Luhmer is the person that came up with the notion of the wide soul or the soul with size. But Luhmer and Maland were both quite suspicious of, number one, Whitehead's understanding of God, but number two, Whitehead's desire to do a metaphysic. And what they really more appreciated was his understanding of experience as such. So it was kind of more like Deweyan in approach, you know. And so personally, I think in the process movement, there's room for all three. But I want to make space for the empirical. And so I resist identifying the process movement as such as interested in the speculative mode alone. That middle ground, the rationalist mode, have you studied much Hartshorne and say
Yeah.
his take on the ontological argument for God's existence? You know, he thinks it works.
Right.
And he's developed it. And you know, I don't think Whitehead ever would have thought it could work. And Whitehead didn't think you could get to existence through definitions. But Hartshorne was logically rigorous to the extreme. And any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm definitely far less familiar with Hartshorne. I feel like I've mostly been exposed to him through some of our contemporary process
Dan
folks. And
Dabrowski is quite
yeah,
influenced by
absolutely.
him. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean his work is really compelling, especially his recent process mysticism. I think that really kind of brought us to some new places in kind of discourse about mysticism. Yeah, I like the rationalist bent too. I for sure think there's a place for that as well. I will say I do feel perhaps amongst the more Hartshornean folks, some of this kind of stronger caricaturing of classical theism. But at the same time, I mean, you have this work by Hartshorne himself looking at tragedy in God coming from Whitehead. Yeah. And is it Berdyaev that
Nicholas Berdyaev?
Yeah,
yes
I think that's right. So that's a fascinating
yes
kind of engagement that I mean, that's those are some of the kinds of discourses I'd really like to see more of, connecting with some of those 20th century sociology discourses coming out of Eastern Christianity there.
Yeah.
I think having some of those connections, I think it will just kind of really kind of help emphasize certain valuable aspects of the process, the tradition that maybe have precedent in other discourses and maybe aren't so totally different and new and kind of incompatible with say more traditional or just kind of other forms of metaphysics, theology, religious thinking. I mean, my guy Henri Corbin is really interesting here, as he was very much in conversation with some of those authors as well, those Russian sociologists. So I think you could draw an interesting conversational line from process to these Eastern Orthodox 20th century theologians to Corbin to Sufi and
Sufism,
Shi'i
yeah.
Neoplatonism. And man, what a more interesting kind of genealogy and landscape of thought you have there versus just, oh, there's neoclassical process theism versus classical theism.
Right.
Feels very, very Christian centric in a lot of ways. And so
I think that Corbin's notion of the imaginal is really worth exploring. You know, we tend in the process world tend to talk about actuality and potentiality, actual entities and eternal objects, to use process and reality language. But what lies in between? And Whitehead had a word for that, a kind of halfway house. It was his word propositions. I mean, that's a terrible word to name something so rich. But fact of the matter is, propositions were impure potentialities. That was his phrase. They involved a sense of the actual and the potential together. But I take it the realm of the imaginal, it's not exactly physical. It's not purely mathematical. And it seems to me immensely rich, powerful, and influential, actually, in human life. So what do you think? What themes in Corbin do you think we could explore?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the imaginal. And I do see a number of process people getting into this topic of imagination. Yeah, it's popped up here and there. I mean, it's not one of the most prominent topics I see, but it does come up. I mean, I think an easy way to kind of plug it into, the process and reality schema. I think there's a way that imagination is quite analogous to the conceptual prehension that goes on in actual occasions.
And Whitehead also talked about propositional prehensions, which were different from conceptual. And so they were working with those hybrid objects, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, Corbin says that sort of the imaginal aspect of reality is the spot where bodies become spiritualized and spirits become corporealized. It's different than certainly Whitehead's scheme, but what is maybe interesting about trying to plug these into one another is there might be ways to find this imaginal faculty working kind of on all layers of ontology rather than something which, I mean, it's kind of ambiguous in Corbin from what I read in him, but I mean, certainly much more focused on the human, whether sort of mammalian life might have an imaginal faculty or even simpler life forms. It's not really a question so much there.
I would think that dreams, while you're asleep, are a place where the imaginal is tasted. Mm-hmm. And animals certainly dream. You know, my dog sleeps in the same room that I sleep in, and he chases many a rabbit while asleep, barks at him. You know, something's going on there in their images. Mm-hmm. You know, one way that that all this is relevant, it seems to me, is to look at the current social and political climate of the world. And that includes the United States. And that includes the rise of populism and the rise of progressivism as polar opposites. But as I look at the language, the memes, the cultures of both of those groups, they are rather profoundly shaped, as am I, by images, stories, myths, narratives that are not exactly reducible to physical realities to be analyzed by science, are purely conceptual realities to be explored by mathematicians. And so the relationship between the imaginal and the political and the social, I think is worth thinking about. And I don't know whether I think process thought tries to offer an alternative imaginary. You know, that'd be one way to look at it. It's this ongoing attempt to propose an alternative imaginary, but maybe so, maybe not. Any thoughts on your part on that?
Yeah, one of the recurring critiques I've heard of the process tradition in a political vein is that it seems to pretty readily and without too much seeming intentional thought kind of fall into a progressive liberal stance, whereas there are myriad kind of options, especially looking at the various left wing kind of political imaginaries that have come up in the past couple of centuries that are critical of a kind of liberal tradition coming out of people like Locke, Adam Smith, these folks. And I don't know that this kind of progressive liberalism is necessarily the best fit for process thought, especially the kind of anthropology that's kind of implicitly embedded in a lot of that stuff of human being as blank slate, state of nature, kind of stuff. I don't think that really fits. And likewise, some of the economic thought scaffolded atop that. I think there are definitely process critiques of these things, and you do see that. I mean, certainly John Cobb's work on economics has cut pretty strongly against neoliberal capitalist conceptions. And you have seen a number of kind of scattered engagements with Marxism, but yeah, especially in the kind of generation coming out of Claremont, I think there's a lot of kind of general progressive liberal sort of standpoint that is perhaps insufficiently kind of critically interrogated. So I think, seeing what other options are possible for political imaginaries coming out of a kind of deep engagement with the process tradition, Whitehead and beyond, not certainly confined to his thought. I think that would be very, very valuable. And I think especially people more in my generation are pretty hungry for things that are, they have a little edge to them, not kind of falling into this a little bit kind of feel good progressivism. Because I think, for people my age and younger, some of the current crises are just so top of mind. The climate emergency, the kind of slide towards much more authoritarian political structures, issues of pretty significant racism structurally, systematically. And so it can be hard to feel connected when the political kind of imaginary presented kind of has this 60s feel good progressivism to its aesthetics.
Do you see the progressivism, the progressive imaginary, as individualistic?
Yeah, I mean, it can definitely have that bent.
A focus on individual rights as kind of one of its a centerpiece, a bottom line. I'm really wondering, is that part of the progressive mentality or not? What do you think?
I think this is one of those classic situations where you can have both manifestations of individuality and individualism. And I'd say that in its, at its best, progressivism can be a really kind of wonderful affirmation of individuality in the sense of honoring and celebrating the true like uniqueness and irreducibility of a particular person and all their intersecting identity experiences. But on the negative, it can for sure drift towards this very American Western individualism where people are kind of atomized selves and are kind of reifying some of their identity categories in ways that can be I mean, from a process perspective, I mean, it's kind of disregarding some of the interconnectivity and interrelationality that is kind of a metaphysical basic. And so I mean, that's kind of some of the struggle about identity politics in the past decade and a half is this dawning consciousness of intersectionality in terms of identity, but that can have a underbelly of reifying categories, dividing people in various ways, claiming that experience is inaccessible kind of by default when kind of crossing identity lines, like, oh, you could never understand the experience of such and such a person belonging to this marginalized group if you are not a member. But that can be very difficult then to foster solidarity and helpful kind of collaboration and community building across these identity lines. So yeah, and I mean there's some communitarianism to it, there's some individualism to it, but yeah, there's definitely some less savory aspects to progressivism, and some people don't see this and are definitely trying to do what they can with within the confines of that political imaginary. Some people are really concerned about it and trying to find alternatives that nonetheless kind of include many of the important insights that the progressive perspective has given in the past century. But then there's also a lot of people who are taking reactionary stances against some of the perceived issues in progressivism. So it's certainly a complex situation here. Steve McIntosh, this integral cultural theorist, political guy, has done some interesting work in this vein, trying to look at these different ideological camps and such from a more developmental lens. And he's certainly drawing a lot on both Whitehead and also Pierre Teilhard de Chardin in some of that work. So I mean, it's interesting stuff to see. Some of those projects that try to broaden the conversation and actually engage a lot of these kind of vibrant political positions you have nowadays, even if they're not necessarily savory ones. I think that there's a hunger for that, and I think the process thinking can really provide a lot of value there. I know our friend Matt Segal has really been in conversation with a lot of the much more right leaning folks that are rising to prominence in some of the adjacent digital spheres to our community. I think that's really valuable as well, for sure.
And for the common good, Cobb and Daly said that if you want to understand what we're getting at, don't think in terms of capitalism or socialism. We're actually trying to point to another option that's not quite captured in either of those two terms. And as far as I can tell, it's a kind of communitarianism. As far as I can tell, for the common good, that particular version of a process economics, it leans strongly toward communitarianism. And it builds upon a Catholic tradition of subsidiarity. You know, when decisions must be made, and they do need to be made, let them be made at the level closest to the people affected when possible. So decisions can be made nationally, but the default, if possible, is local decision making. But that itself can fall into profound forms of parochialism, because local cultures can be deeply parochial, be racist, sexist, all kinds of things. But also there is a kind of empowerment when people feel like they get to make the decisions that affect their lives, politically and in other ways as well. So in any case, I see Cobb as in the, myself, I see him as in the communitarian tradition, but wanting to make space for individuality within the context of communitarianism. And I remember once I was with him in China, and the whole question emerged. A lot of process people that went to China from the West, they thought, oh, China has Confucianism and it's all about relationality, and finally we'll find a place where relationality is part of the normative way of thinking rather than an exception, et cetera. And they would wave the flag of relationality and nod their heads at their Chinese friends as if, and don't you agree? But the younger Chinese, I would say, we've had too much relationality. We've had too much. We're totally absorbed in forms of relationality that are stifling and unhealthy, related not only to politics, but to family life. Is there a place for me to have an opinion, for me to speak my voice, for me to claim a kind of individuality? And I think the Western process thinkers had deaf ears there. They didn't hear that, because they were so keen on overcoming the atomism of Western individualism. But there's some place in between an emphasis on relationality and healthy individuality that I think process thought strives toward. I don't know if it's there, but that's where the right wing comes in. A lot of these right wing folks, you take some of the people running for office even today, they're for trying to reclaim a certain kind of communitarian life. And that's an interesting place where process can meet them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the values within a lot more conservative or right-leaning sentiment that I find compelling and valuable is some of the communitarian stuff, but also a greater acknowledgement of being in a tradition, being in a lineage, having this precedent and a deeper past that one is within, but also has responsibility to take forward. And I think that makes good sense to me. And I think that's something that I think the process tradition has a lot of resources to engage with as
well. I think
well.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it's odd that that's been forgotten, but I think you're right. I mean, obviously the process tradition, we're deeply indebted to the past. There is no present without memory, lineage, conscious and unconscious, and rituals that help us reclaim and be renewed by the past, honoring our elders, human and more than human. It's odd. It's odd that we might have fallen into a forgetfulness of that. It's odd. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the traditionalism of which you're speaking is a reclaiming of that, as I understand it.
Yeah. And I think the taking a process perspective on it can help get beyond some of the kind of reified ways that this is often thought of in more mainstream kind of conservative thought, where something like the nuclear family is kind of this essential unit, and again you have some of these discrete social organizations and identity categories that are kind of brought front and center as kind of essential modes of organization for achieving some of this gratefulness and continuity and such. But I mean, there's a real dark side to a lot of those things as well. So I think, process can acknowledge some of that, but also give a lot more flexibility and dynamism to, bring in some more progressive concerns, especially more ecological concerns. I think that's a major point missing in a lot of contemporary conservative thought, but it need not be. Connect these things together. I mean, we're not only in a religious and kind of worldview lineage, but we are also in a kind of ecological, biological lineage. And they're different, but they're also interweaving and have all kinds of unique ways that they manifest in our lives in important ways.
Well, Jared, what in our series do you want to do with the arts and the world of sound, music, visual arts, film, drama? In the House of Arts, there's so many rooms. Culinary arts. So I know that you're interested in music and sound, and I am too. And also, but you, the visual dimensions, you do calligraphy. Where should we go in that direction, or how should we proceed?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly look forward to bringing all kinds of different artistic and spiritual practitioners on talk about not only these more kind of conceptual discourses about ideas, philosophy, science, metaphysics, but to be able to explore someone's engagement in deep artistic practice in a way that can hopefully in our conversations we can further open some doors to richness and understanding through weaving in some of the more conceptual philosophical, but conversely show some ways that a lot of this values and the concerns that are within our kind of broader process community here can be instantiated in the world in all kinds of different modes of engagement, personal artistic practice, communal sorts of engagements, dance, theatrics, communal ritual. There's a lot of stuff to explore there, to be sure.
It's so holistic. One thing that I wonder about, Jared, and maybe you can help me think this through. I think it was T.S. Eliot. You know, T.S. Eliot started out as a philosopher and then decided that wasn't for him. He turned to poetry and did a fairly decent job as a poet, I might say. I think part of what drew him to poetry was its concrete images. And he thought that they maybe spoke in a way and spoke, that perhaps they spoke truths that were not found in abstractions, in syllogisms. And so it may not have been Eliot, it may have been somebody else that talked about the concrete universal, use that phrase, the concrete universal as the way that particular images, particular stories, particular rituals, this, that, or the other. A lot of times, if you're philosophically minded, you would think that the purpose of an image, for example, is to illustrate a more general principle. That's to say, the particular is important insofar as it points back to the universal. But I think Eliot's point was really different. The universal is completed and incomplete without the particular. So I kind of think I want to give the arts, insofar as they focus on concrete images and sounds and rituals and this, that, or the other, that kind of credit. Not simply that they illustrate process ideas, but that they are themselves communicators as such, as something important. I think that's Whiteheadian. I don't know if it has to be, but I think it is.
I think so too. Yeah, absolutely. There's something of, creativity is certainly exemplified in all of these things, and there's certainly novelty that could not be achieved otherwise, which is achieved through the arts. And may there be myriad connections to all sorts of things we care about in the process.
Well, so you have in mind some people that we'll be inviting for this, and I do too, and I really look forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd certainly invite anyone in our community, any listeners, to send us suggestions for folks to talk with on this show. This is a collaborative venture, certainly beyond just Jay and I here. So we invite you to engage and participate in any way you can, and may it be all the richer as a result.
Sounds good to me.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening to our first episode here, and we will certainly be back with more soon. So stay tuned.